From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, sitting in for Terry Gross, who's on assignment. On today's Fresh Air, Losing Absalom. Alex Pate's novel was inspired by his father, a devoted family man. Pate says we don't hear enough about men like this. And we'll speak with writer and chess fan Fred Waitzkin, author of the book Searching for Bobby Fischer. His son Josh is the chess prodigy who inspired the story. Pop music critic Ken Tucker reviews two new country albums from Hal Ketchum and David Ball. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Keith Jarrett's new album at the Deerhead Inn. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Noor Rahm. The rebels attempting to bring down the government in Rwanda have declared victory. They say they will now stop fighting and form their own government as early as tomorrow. In Bosnia, the warring factions must determine the future of the region's latest peace plan. Tomorrow is the deadline set by international mediators. The Bosnian president won approval from his parliament, claiming a continuation of the war would benefit the Serbs. There are fears the Bosnian Serbs may reject the plan. The BBC's Malcolm Brabant is in Sarajevo.
The Muslim Assembly voted by 85% to 15% to approve the Geneva plan. Many of those delegates will take part in the parliamentary vote that will determine Bosnia's formal response. The Prime Minister, Haris Salajic, told Parliament that the plan rewarded aggression and ethnic cleansing, but he appealed for an unconditional acceptance, saying the main plus was that it guaranteed the preservation of Bosnia's sovereignty. Bosnia's leaders have been encouraged by General Rose's suggestion that 50,000 NATO troops may replace the United Nations with a robust peace-enforcing operation. But Mohamed Shakabe, Bosnia's ambassador to the UN, said he feared that militant Serbs would relish the chance to challenge NATO.
The BBC's Malcolm Brabant. A powerful explosion tore through a building in central Buenos Aires today. Police suspect it was a bomb. According to radio and television reports, 16 people were killed and several people were injured. The building housed offices belonging to the Jewish community in Buenos Aires. In Jerusalem, Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres described the incident as a terrorist attack. 2 years ago, 30 people were killed when a bomb went off at the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires. The largest fragment yet of the comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 hit Jupiter this morning. NPR's Joe Palco reports that scientists are busy recording the results, including black scars said to be the size of Earth.
The latest fragment, known to astronomers as Fragment G, was supposed to be one of the bigger ones. Earlier fragments had exceeded expectations by producing plumes of hot gas detectable from Earth. Astronomers were predicting a spectacular show from G. Based on size estimates, they expected the impact from G would be 25 times as powerful as the impact from the first fragment that hit Jupiter on Saturday. They weren't disappointed. According to astronomers at the Keck Telescope in Hawaii, G sent a tremendous fireball of hot gas soaring hundreds of miles above Jupiter. The impact from G caused a black spot to appear on the planet, as has occurred with some of the earlier impacts. This is Joe Palca in Washington.
Checking stocks on Wall Street this hour, the Dow Jones average of 30 industrials is up 0.65 points at 37.54.46 in active trading of 200 million shares. You're listening to National Public Radio News. Negotiators for Jordan and Israel met today at a gap in the barbed wire separating the two countries. They're taking the first historic steps towards a treaty to end a 46-year-old state of war. The head of the Israeli delegation said, "I'm sure this is workable." Secretary of State Warren Christopher has begun a new Middle East mission, meeting today with Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin in Jerusalem. Later, he declared that the Arab-Israeli conflict, one of the most long-standing and most intractable conflicts of this entire century, he said, is drawing to an end. During his week-long trip, Christopher is also to visit Syria and Jordan. Eight anti-abortion protesters are defendants in a lawsuit filed today by a Milwaukee medical clinic. In bringing the suit, the clinic becomes the first in the nation to seek civil damages against anti-abortion protesters under a provision in the Federal Freedom of Access to Clinics Act. Annalise Hensel of member station WUWM reports.
Six of the eight defendants already face federal criminal charges for chaining themselves to two cars that blocked the entrance to the Affiliated Medical Services Clinic in June. Their arrests were the first under the clinic protection legislation that President Clinton signed into law in May. The defendants face up to 6 months in jail and $10,000 in fines for the criminal charges. They're now being sued for an additional $5,000 in statutory damages and unspecified punitive damages in the civil case. The plaintiff is also seeking a permanent injunction against the defendants to keep them from holding similar protests in the future. Planned Parenthood is sponsoring the suit. For National Public Radio, I'm Annalise Hensel in Milwaukee.
Rosanna Della Corte gave birth to a son today in Rome. She also produced a new record. She's the oldest woman to give birth. Della Corte is 62 years old. Although past menopause, she became pregnant through artificial insemination and carried the baby to term with the help of hormone treatments. I'm Nora Rahm, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Alex Pate wrote his first novel, Losing Absalom, as a tribute to his father. He said, "When my father died, I was struck by the fact that there were precious few images of men like him in the popular culture, even fewer in literature. I wanted to show that men like Absalom, men who worked hard and were devoted husbands and fathers, lived." Pate's novel chronicles the end of Absalom Goodman's life as he lies dying in a Philadelphia hospital. Absalom floats in and out of consciousness as his family tries to imagine what life will be like without him. Alex Pate grew up in North Philadelphia and now lives in Minneapolis. For many years, he worked in the corporate world. He gave that up to be a writer, poet, and performance artist. In the novel, Absalom measures his worth by the accomplishments of his son. Pate told me it was the same with his own father.
My father, I think, accepted the fact that he was a blue-collar truck driver and that his life was had its limits that weren't necessarily related to racism, but simply to his own choices and his own limitations of education, which, you know, we can all track everything back to racism and what have you. But there are conditions, I think, that people grow up under. My father grew up on a farm in the South. He didn't finish high school. So he looked at his life and said, I can be the best truck driver I can be, and I can create a children who can go on and be other things. And I think, so then as I started to work and move into the corporate world, I could tell that he really took a lot of pride and pleasure in the fact that I had made that leap.
Well, in your novel about Absalom, his family gathers around him. He's dying in a Philadelphia hospital. Mm-hmm. Part of the book is the kind of journeys he takes throughout his mm-hmm. life and mm-hmm. his thoughts about his children. The other part of the novel is the living, and they're trying to figure out what this man has meant to them and what they're going
right.
to do when he does die.
Right. Right.
Were you able, as your father was dying, to talk to him, to have the kinds of, it's almost a cliche to say this, but the kinds of conversations
yeah.
that fathers and sons seem to long to have?
Well, you know, it's really strange. I tell this story, and this is a true story. I was in therapy. Breaking up with a girlfriend at the time, a long-term relationship, and I was very upset, so I was in therapy. I was talking, and it was a black woman who was a therapist, and in the middle of explaining my problem, she asked me about my mother, and I told her how much I knew about my mother, and she says, well, it seems like you know a lot about your mother. Tell me about your father, which is when I began to realize, hey, I don't really know my father that well. And so she said, you know what? Your mother is a very strong woman, and your father has been married to her for so long. I think you ought to call your father and ask him about some of the problems that you have in your life. Now, I mean, for a woman therapist to tell me to ask my father about anything other than baseball is just unbelievable, to ask him about my personal problems. But I came home, picked up the phone, said, Dad, you know, I was talking to my counselor, and she said, I should ask you about some of this stuff. And he said, well, it's about time.
Were you scared to have this kind of conversation with your father?
Well, I just never thought. Yes, I was terrified, of course. I mean, first of all, I never thought about it. Never thought that he could know anything that I didn't know. I mean, you know, as a child, you grow up, you learn as much as you can learn. And when your parents are less educated than you, you tend to think, well, you know, they don't know. But my father knew so much more than I did that I didn't know he knew.
Right.
So that year, when this is before he was sick, that next year, which is the year preceding his illness, we got to be very close. Now, did our conversations change substantively? I'm not sure. But I feel I bonded with him so that as he lay there dying, I could say to him, you know, Dad, I'm really sorry I can't change this for you. I really wish that I could do something about this, but I can't. What I can do is I could try to tell your story.
Hmm. Were you with your father when he died?
Not at the moment he died. In fact, I was with him to the day before he died, and I had to go back to Minnesota, and I was on a plane, I think, when he died.
Did you want to be there, though, when he died?
I wasn't sure. I think in moments like that, you sort of cast yourself to the moment, and you take, because any moment it could have happened, and I could have been there. So I was prepared for it, and yet it wasn't what I wanted to do. There's a thing about me and death. I don't really want to see death. I mean, I understand death very well. I have a very clear intellectual picture of what death is. And yet, I didn't really participate in a funeral. I was there. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want to see my father lifeless. Seeing him sick was bad enough.
When the novel begins, we meet Sonny. He's an executive. He works in Minneapolis. You write a black man on the move. But he also, as you write, carries a secret that he's afraid.
Yes.
Afraid of what?
Afraid of, well, I think there are a multiple array of fears there. One fear, I think, is that he'll fail. And that he'll fail Absalom's hope in him, his sense of achievement, vicarious achievement, that he'll fail that. But I think there's another failure, and that is the failure or fear that he doesn't belong there, that he really just doesn't. As an African-American man working in a corporate world, you get moments where you just feel like you don't really belong there.
Why?
That it was set up not for you. Nobody thought about you when they did this, that the dress code, the work ethic, the process, the sense of the old boy, old girls network, depending on where you are, the type of business it is, the sense that money and the exploitation of people sometimes is the goal as opposed to helping people. I mean, you just sometimes feel like as a black person with so many other black people out there in trouble and in wretched existence, that you should be doing something different.
Well, reading about Sonny reminded me of Ellis Coase, who's been a guest on this show, talking about the mm-hmm. rage of the black middle class.
Mm-hmm.
Do you identify with that?
Yes, I do. But I think that we sort of trap ourselves, too. I think that the problem is that we are trapped into wanting the same things that we see around us. And, of course, we should, and we must mm-hmm. strive to do that. But it's a catch-22 because it takes you away from yourself in a way that I don't think it's very easy to rediscover. So, yeah, there is a rage. But I think many people sort of quiet it and snuff it out and aren't able to express it. It comes out in really kind of bizarre ways. That's what he...
Yeah, in what ways?
Well, I mean, I think it comes out in abuse to children and spouses. I think it comes out in substance abuse. And I think it comes out in high blood pressure and in cancer. I really believe that African-American men in particular make themselves sicker than they need to, that we are constantly struggling against the system we inherently feel is against us. And instead of sort of figuring out ways to adjust our own interior lives to coincide with our outside world, we always fight. It's almost like instinctively that we fight.
How different did you look? I mean, I'm looking at you. We're on the radio.
Yeah, right.
How different did you look?
Well,
I did
not have dreadlocks.
Okay.
I told somebody I earned every one of these dreadlocks. I was still not the corporate clean-cut guy. Mm-hmm. I always was the guy in the corner office who one of my major skills was problem solving, crisis management. So I often went to places where there were all kinds of problems going on, and I really liked the idea of working as a team with a lot of people to do the same thing. It's a great thing, and yet I found myself really unsatisfied.
Back to the novel, mm-hmm. Sonny. And when I read about Sonny, I thought of you, mm-hmm. but it seems fairly autobiographical. Mm-hmm. He calls education the modern underground railroad. Ticket out of slavery, ticket out of oppression.
Ticket out of the hood. It's the only...
Was that your ticket out of the hood?
Oh, of course. It was my ticket out of the hood. I mean, actually, I went in the Navy for 4 years, which is another way out. But often, you know, we tend to, if we go to the military, we often come back to the hood. You have to sort of get away, go to school to have that chance to get out. But, you know, there's a price to that, you know, that leaving. I'm really happy that I had that opportunity to get out. We are told, are trained by our parents to look for the first opportunity to get an education and get out of here so that you can go on and have a good life.
The price is
that we leave the community behind, and the community suffers for our absence.
Sonny comes back to Philadelphia to be with his father and to be with his family. And for you who grew up in North Philadelphia, coming back, what's it like? How different is it?
It's sad.
Sad.
I mean, I love the people that I see, my friends, my family. But there's a sadness that I think that is sort of creeping through inner city Philadelphia. That is through every other major inner city. That is just sad. I mean, there's a scariness to it, but it's also just sad. There is a kind of hopelessness, a struggle against this rage of crack, a struggle against the kind of governmental indifference or inability, really, to get their hands around the problem. I mean, I was in Washington the other day, and her son had been shot. But then there was a young man shot here yesterday, too, and as there is almost every day, and the mothers are saying, there's something seriously wrong here. Something seriously wrong. My son could just be shot like this. Well, there is something seriously wrong. Now, which is not to say that I lived in some wonderful, idyllic time. You know, the 60s and the 70s in the inner city, North Philly, weren't. I mean, it was gang capital of the country at the time. And yet, this kind of violence and anger and rage and is scary and sad.
Well, you had an essay about growing up in North Philadelphia in the 60s, and I think people do forget
right. That
the gangs were pretty powerful, and there was a certain level of violence.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And you had to navigate through that violence.
Yes.
Is it different today, or how different is the violence?
Well, I think I'm watching young black boys navigate their way through. Okay, so it can be done. And yet, the technology has changed. We have automatic weapons. We didn't have automatic weapons. That changes things right away. The technology of drug abuse is greater. I mean, there were heroin addicts in my neighborhood and probably pot users, although I don't even remember that, but I remember heroin addicts. Crack addicts are totally different than heroin addicts. They're active. And PCP addicts are active as opposed to benign. Not benign. Heroin addicts weren't benign when they needed a fix, but when they were under the influence, they were almost not a factor. You didn't have to worry about them. And so I think that the threats to health and vitality in the inner city are much greater because of the technological advances that we've made.
You said you joined the Navy. What was this, after high school?
Yes.
And so what, back in the late 60s?
Mm-hmm. 68 to 72.
Was the Navy your ticket out, as you seen?
Yeah, it was. Earlier? It was. We were sitting around on the steps one night, not knowing what to do, and somebody had already gone down to the recruiter's office, so four of us just joined up together at the same time.
So it was that spontaneous?
It was that spontaneous. I had not a clue about what I was going to do.
If this was the late 60s, how close to the Vietnam War did you get?
I spent all my time in Europe. Yeah, and on ships out to sea, but never to Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. So in that way, I was lucky. I mean, and yet I felt like, you know, I was a part of that and was as conflicted about that as everybody else was.
What did the Navy give you?
The Navy gave me a sense of, first of all, I learned how to type in the Navy. I wound up being an aide to an admiral at the end of my tenure there. So I learned the naval bureaucracy, which got me, I think once I got to corporate America, made me very capable of being successful. I lived with 350 white men, predominantly white men, on a ship for 6 months at a time. That really was immeasurable in my ability then to communicate and negotiate my way through our society. I think that we have to work harder at getting people to understand that they have to deal with each other in our society. It's not always pleasant, but you must be able to stand up for yourself and negotiate.
When you said that, it got me thinking, when you have interactions with a white person, is it always about race? Do you always Are you always aware of the color
of your
skin? Not
anymore. Oh, yes. I'm always aware
of
the color of my skin and the color of that person's skin. And I think that I don't have the privilege of thinking that nobody's going to see me as a black man. I just don't have that. It would be great to go somewhere and not think that somebody's seeing me as a black man walk through the door. But if I go to my hotel, if I go to hail a cab, no matter what I'm doing, I am conscious that they see me as a black person. Consequently, it makes me have to see them as white people. I don't want to.
Right.
It's
right.
Not the way I choose to live my life.
When did you start to write?
I started to write in high school. Uh-huh. I started to write sitting out on a corner with my friends. I started writing little stupid poems, and they would chase me down the street and tease me about it. But
not the poems.
So I encourage,
not the poems, but the kids, right?
Yeah, right. I encourage young men who have a sense of writing. And I wonder, would I have turned into a rap artist if I had come up now? But the whole idea, I really encourage young people now to not be afraid to express yourself and to even deal with the response to that. We have to do that.
Do you think with the direction that your career is going and the fact that you're now a published novelist, that you'll be made a spokesman for your race, your generation, and do you have any desire to do that at all?
No, I have no desire to do that because I think the power is in the continued struggle to be honest, to be truthful. My next novel will be called For Children with Missing Fathers, about the whole struggle of black men and absenteeism in the family. And I don't want to be penned in, hemmed in too much before I have a chance to say what I want to say. You start worrying about what people are going to think, you know, about what you're saying, and you start saying things differently. And I'm too young to do that.
Alex Bates' novel is called Losing Absalom. He's also a poet and a performance artist. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews two new country recordings after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Rock critic Ken Tucker has been listening to a lot of country music these days, and he's come up with two favorites, one from an established star, the other a newcomer. Here are his reviews of Hal Ketchum's Every Little Word and David Ball's Thinkin' Problem. Here's Hal Ketchum.
Don't know where, don't know when, this road I'm on is gonna end. It's been my friend, it's been my sin, my next of kin. Traveled high, traveled low, the rain still falls, the wind still blows. One thing I've learned, one thing I know, there ain't no easy road.
For the past couple of years, Hal Ketchum has developed a big following for his country crooning, and on his third release, Every Little Word, he proves he's a softy with a spine. He contrasts his smoky tenor with spare, dry folk instrumentation that doesn't neglect a juicy beat now and then. With his movie star good looks and sensitive guy attitude, Ketchum is frequently dismissed among serious country fans as a lightweight. But I hear him as the best justification possible for middle-of-the-road country music.
Somehow we let it slip right through our fingers. Somewhere we left our love along the way. Now after all the life we've lived between us, how can we have nothing more to say? Let's put aside the pain and all the sorrow. Stop talking about the way things might have been. Into
might fall in love again.
Hal Ketchum's career is firmly established, but David Ball's is just starting. His first album, called Thinkin' Problem, is, as far as I'm concerned, the country debut of the year, just bursting with old-fashioned honky-tonk music. I was afraid this meant that Ball had no chance for success, because right now, country radio stations could not care less about old-fashioned styles.
Yes, I admit I've got a thinking problem. She's always on my mind. Her memory goes round. I'll start with loving her, but I don't know when to stop.
Well, it turns out that the title song of Ball's album is such an instant classic, a great song with a novelty hook in its title, that it looks like it's becoming a hit single anyway. Ball is a young singer steeped in tradition. He's got that George Jones clench to his teeth, that Merle Haggard growl in the back of his throat. And like all the good old country stars, he can't keep away from a corny pun that illuminates romantic pain. One song's chorus is, "I say I've burned her memory, but I'm just blowing smoke." Even better is this.
I did some honky-tonk healing to get me over you. It took some neon nurses around the clock to pull me through. I was in critical condition. My heart was broken in two. Due to honky-tonk healing, I'm feeling good as new.
At a time when country music is chock-full of mannerly mannequins who don't sound as if they've ever consumed anything stronger than a non-alcoholic beer, what a relief it is to hear David Ball's barroom voice of experience. Between the two of them, Ball and Hal Ketchum are helping to keep country music honest.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Hal Ketchum's new album, Every Little Word, and David Ball's Thinkin' Problem. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air. Here's Hal Ketchum with Drive On.
Somewhere back in the good old days, I missed the last train home. I mastered more than a million ways. I turned my soul to stone. I have taken love, I have taken trust, given little in return. I have held a match to my careless dreams and watched them burn. Drive on,
drive on,
don't look back, drive on, drive on,
drive on,
don't look back, drive on. You can't walk this world in a long straight line, never taste the tears. You can't let the thrill of just one more lie chase you through the years. But on that final day when they lay you down, what will you have to show? Will there be someone there to say goodbye when it's time to go? Drive on,
drive on,
don't look back, drive on, drive on,
drive on.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Coming up, Fred Waitzkin is the real-life father of the chess prodigy made famous in the book and the movie, Searching for Bobby Fischer. Waitzkin himself also loves the game, and his second book, Mortal Games, follows world chess champion Garry Kasparov as he prepares to defend his title. Waitzkin tells us about the intense competition and tension that accompanies world championship chess matches. And Kevin Whitehead reviews At the Deerhead Inn, the new album by jazz pianist Keith Jarrett, who teams up with bassist Gary Peacock and drummer Paul Motion. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The rebels who have been battling the government in Rwanda for the past 14 weeks today claim they won and the fighting is over. They plan to install a new government as early as tomorrow. Meanwhile, the mass exodus out of the country continues. State Department spokesman Mike McCurry says that literally millions of Rwandans have fled the bloodshed, a human flood of refugees.
The number of refugees who have fled the conflict in Rwanda to the neighboring countries of Tanzania, Zaire, Uganda, and Burundi has now reached over 2 million. The flow of almost 1 million people into the Goma area of Zaire over the last few days is unprecedented.
McCurry said the administration has authorized another $19 million in humanitarian aid to deal with the crisis. An explosion brought down a seven-story building in Buenos Aires this morning. Police report that at least 22 people were killed and more than 100 were injured. The building was home to two Jewish organizations. The cause of the blast has not yet been determined. President Carlos Menem said the attack was planned from abroad and helped by people there. He called the perpetrators beasts and savages. 2 years ago, a bomb destroyed the Israeli embassy in downtown Buenos Aires, killing 28 people. At the United Nations, the General Assembly has completed negotiations for the creation of a post aimed at rooting out mismanagement and abuse. The move follows intense pressure from the United States for a better system of oversight of the world body. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
The new position is charged with overseeing the world body's $1.4 billion annual budget, as well as the current $3 billion a year spent on peacekeeping around the globe. In an effort to press the UN to be more accountable, the U.S. Congress had withheld about $420 million in annual payments, money that Washington is expected to make available. U.S. Ambassador Madeleine Albright.
This action should help give the American people the confidence that our money is being spent wisely. Achieving this goal has been a central plank of the Clinton administration's effort to reinvent the United Nations, not to tear it down, but to make it work.
Not only will the new position help to eliminate waste and corruption, but it will also evaluate the efficiency of the UN's programs. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
Violence erupted today in Lagos, Nigeria during pro-democracy demonstrations. Organizers claim that at least 20 people were killed during clashes with police. Last year, nearly 190 people were killed during a protest against the annulment of Nigerians' elections. On Wall Street, stock prices closed marginally higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 1.62 points to close at 3755.43. Advancers led decliners by just 100 issues and heavy trading of 227 million shares. This is National Public Radio News. Fragment G struck the backside of Jupiter today, creating the most powerful planetary explosion ever observed. Fragment G was one of the largest of 21 fragments of a comet colliding with Jupiter. Astronomers report that when it hit, it immediately became a fireball that for a few minutes was brighter than the entire planet. The government's latest report on fraud and waste in the nation's food stamp program shows that thousands of people last year received benefits they weren't entitled to. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The Agriculture Department says almost 9% of all food stamp benefits went to people who were ineligible or collected more than they were entitled to receive. The agency says mistakes and fraud cost the program $1.8 billion last year. USDA says fraud and mistakes on the state and local level quickly add up to large amounts of money. The latest figures show that thousands of low-income people were denied benefits totaling $559 million because of mistakes made in running the welfare program. Representative Ron Wyden is chairman of the House Subcommittee on Regulation. According to information obtained by Wyden's office, federal spending on state and local welfare fraud investigations has fallen under the Clinton administration, and the number of investigators has also dropped from 53 in 1992 to 47 today. Wyden says the increase in food stamp fraud and errors could damage the administration's efforts to reform the welfare system. Senator Patrick Leahy, chairman of the Senate Agriculture Committee, says cutting waste and fraud out of the food stamp program should be the first step in reforming welfare. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
Electronic tax return filing, which makes it easier to get the refund that's coming to you, has made it easier for crooks to get the refund that shouldn't be coming to them. The Internal Revenue Service estimates that the computer filing meant that the bad guys received $15 million that they didn't deserve in the 1993 tax return year. I'm Nora Rahm, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Josh Waitzkin turned his father into a writer and a devotee of chess. Fred Waitzkin's first book, Searching for Bobby Fischer, was about the discovery of his young son Josh's gift for chess and about their developing relationship against the backdrop of cutthroat competition. The book was made into a movie of the same name, and it's just out in video. Waitzkin's second book, Mortal Games, was a portrait of the world chess champion Garry Kasparov as he prepared to defend his title against his sworn enemy, Anatoly Karpov, in 1990. This was more than just a game between rivals, Kasparov said of his opponent. He's a creature of darkness. I'm going to crush him. Fred Waitzkin has found from watching chess that it's more than just a quiet cerebral sport. In fact, he says, it's downright violent.
I think it is a violent sport. Most people tend to look at chess as a cerebral detached activity. But from my experience, both with my son and with chess players that I've gotten to know over the years, they're churning inside. You're really matching your intelligence against the intelligence of another person. And on some kind of level, you really want to destroy that person during the course of the game. So I think it's a kind of internal violence as much as anything.
There's a scene in Searching for Bobby Fischer where one of his teachers says, you must hate your opponent. I mean, you must think of your opponent as your enemy. As a parent, did that disturb you?
It did disturb me. I'm not exactly sure that it's true, though. I think that some players do manufacture a hostility toward their opponent, and others don't. I think that the ones that do find that works for them as sportsmen. Mm-hmm. Chess players tend to rev themselves, as other athletes do, by using certain internal gimmicks. And to hate one's opponent works for certain players. For other players, it blows up in their faces. If they hate their opponent, they become distracted in the game. They don't do particularly well.
Now, is chess a game or a sport, or do you care?
Chess is different things to different people. To certain great champions, to the world champion Garry Kasparov, it's a sport and an art at the same time. To some people, it's a science. To some people, it's a sport. To other people, it's a game.
Your son, Josh, is quoted as saying, thinking of this as a sport, that he got more sweated up in preparation for a chess match than he did playing some of the other sports that he does. That there is, I guess, real aerobic activity associated with the game.
Well, for my son, for Josh, who's now 17 and the co-junior champion of the United States now, which means the champion under 21, Josh is very involved with sports. He's been very, very good at baseball and basketball and football. And the idea of entering into this kind of combat against someone is this is how he looks at it, as a sporting contest. But again, as I say, for another kind of personality, it's mm-hmm. an art form. It's something very different.
Now, do you play chess even recreationally?
I used to during 1970, starting in 1972 when Bobby Fischer was playing Boris Spassky for the world championship and really sort of seized the imagination of America. I began to play chess as did many of my friends and many people. But now I'm not a chess player so much as a chess fan.
Well, what does it take to write about chess, which of course is such a psychological game? So much of the activity is taking place between somebody's ears. And as someone who has written a lot, what does it take to get inside the sport?
Well, as a writer, for my entire career, I've always taken on subjects that are close to my heart, and I've avoided topics that were remote to me, that weren't terribly interesting. And I began writing about chess largely because of the play of my son. I sort of fell in love with the game through him, very much in the same way I think that a parent admires his son or daughter if she's great in any other activity or sport. So that's where I came to chess. That's where the passion began. And after that, I began to study the game. I became intrigued with it. Now when I go to a chess match, I watch it very much like an NFL game. I mean, I'm just very, very involved in the flow of the pieces, the attack, the subtleties.
What I noticed, even in watching the movie, looking for Bobby Fischer and the little boy who plays your son, is a chess player himself. And you could see when the camera moved right in on his face and he was contemplating his next move, he was actually contemplating his next 15 moves, that he was able to look ahead in a way that I don't think I could possibly do. I don't know whether you could possibly do as well. But that's a kind of skill that seems just extraordinary to me, to be able to visualize something and to imagine all these moves and keep them all in your head.
It's true. It's remarkable. It's remarkable the way children can play chess at such a high level. And apparently it's a very specific intelligence as well. It doesn't necessarily translate into an ability to be brilliant in mathematics. Mm. My son, for example, who's quite good in mathematics, his gift is for English.
For
writing and language. So, a lot of people think, well, this must imply great ability for algebra. Not necessarily. It seems to be a specific chess talent.
My guest is Fred Waitzkin, author of Searching for Bobby Fischer and Mortal Games. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Fred Waitzkin is my guest. Let me just get back for the audience that got to know your son through your writing and then also through the book the movie that was made of your book, Searching for Bobby Fischer. You said he is the co-junior U.S. champion. The love of the game that he had at the age of 6 and 7 when he discovered it, does he still have that kind of love or has it matured? Has it changed? What does it look like? How does he express it?
I think that when Josh first started playing the game at 6 or 7 years old, it was primarily a sporting activity for him. I mean, he just wanted to go and beat the other guy. He didn't know about the art of the game. I mean, he knew it perhaps implicitly. It was within him in a certain primitive way. Now Josh is a very, very good chess player. I mean, he's fighting to become a grandmaster. He's already an international master, and he appreciates the game as an art form in a different way now than he did when he was 6 or 7 years old.
Part of your struggle as a parent of a gifted child, a child prodigy, it was, and I assume probably still is balancing their gifts against a semblance of a normal childhood. As he's 17 now, as you look back on the childhood he did have, do you think you succeeded as a parent to give him the chance to really express himself as a chess player, but also the ability to be a kid?
Well, this is something that I think all parents worry about, and particularly parents that have children that are gifted or somewhat mm-hmm. gifted at certain specific endeavors. You know, we in the United States we favor the idea of the well-rounded person, and we start to become uneasy if our children are doing things to excess. In Josh's case, we certainly worried about this. We wanted to make sure that he was doing enough sports, that he was studying school enough, that he was having a social life, on and on and on. But as Josh became older, I started to appreciate more and more the fact that if a child is going to become exceptionally good at something, world-class at something, he really has to devote him or herself at it. And when people ask me this question today, parents that have gifted children, you know, what is the relationship mm-hmm. between how much work my son or daughter ought to do with this or that and the rest of his life? I tend to feel more now than I did when Josh was a little boy that if anything, he probably should have done more chess, rather than little chess, because my own personal bias is that you're only terribly good at one or two things in your life. You're not, you know, unless you're Leonardo, you're not good at everything. You're not brilliant at everything. And if you have a gift for something, it's something of a crime not to cultivate it. So when I look back at Joshua's life, which I think was a very well-rounded life, I probably would have encouraged him to study a little bit more chess.
But, you know, I'm thinking of what parents say to their well-rounded average kids. Say they're playing baseball. They lose the game. They're going home. And they say, well, it was only a game. You'll be okay. Better luck next time. But when you have a child like yours or like another child who has a particular gift, it isn't just a game. It's really an expression of themselves. So their winning and losing has a different value attached to it.
It does. It really does. And as a parent, you're tempted to say it's only a game because you don't want your son and daughter to grieve. The pain rips you apart. But on the other hand, I mean, you know, this activity, whether it's tennis or violin or chess, is so central to the child's life and your life as a parent, because you have to realize that a child can't do this himself. It doesn't matter who the child is. If you have an 8- or 9-year-old child that's gifted at something, you need a parent or two parents that are completely in there with this kid, living and dying with him, encouraging him to do his practice. The child simply... Also, I'm asked by parents, you know, should I be encouraging him to work? Or on the other hand, I won't encourage him to work. If he doesn't go off and do it by himself, it shows that he doesn't really want to do it. Not so. Mm. Not so. No 8-year-old is going to close himself into a room and play the piano for 3.5 hours. He needs the encouragement of a parent.
Let me ask you just a quick follow-up on the title of your book, Searching for Bobby mm-hmm. Fischer. Bobby Fischer, of course, a gifted player, extremely controversial person. In the search, I know you weren't personally looking for him, but for who he is in the world of chess, and your son being identified when he was young as the next Bobby Fischer, was there both a fear and a wish? A fear because, as it turns out, Bobby Fischer lives a very strange life. He's anti-Semitic. He's a person who seems to be quite disconnected from other people, and of course, a very gifted player.
Right. Well, you're exactly right. I mean, Bobby Fischer has haunted the American chess scene since 1972. I mean, he won the world championship from Boris Spassky in a thrilling fashion, and at that time, our land was alive with chess. Chess was on the cover of all the major magazines. Fischer was on television with Shelby Lyman. There seemed to be great potential for the game of chess in America. But then instead of defending the title against Anatoly Karpov in 1973, he disappeared and lived the life of a recluse, crazy political ideas, anti-Semitism, a horrible, distorted figure as he grew older in seclusion. The title Searching for Bobby Fischer is undoubtedly metaphoric in the sense that I think that the American chess scene has been searching for a new Bobby Fischer, because if we had a player that was born in America that could challenge for the world championship, it might reinvigorate the game here. As a chess parent myself, yeah, I found it both thrilling and terribly threatening. But my son could never be like Bobby Fischer on a personal level. I mean, he's a very, you know, he's very, I hate that we use this word well-rounded because, you know, it can apply bad things as well as good things, but he's a broadly based person.
Do you enjoy watching your son play? Is that pleasurable for you? And again, reading through your book, I got the feeling that it was really agony.
It can be, and
certainly watching him suffer. And there is suffering in chess, it seems to me.
Well, Marty, when Josh first started playing chess, when he was 6 and 7 years old, and he would play against adults in Washington Square Park mm-hmm. and win some and lose some, it was mainly agony for me. And I think it had to do with the fact that I didn't really believe that he was playing the games. In some crazy way, I thought I was playing the games and he was moving the pieces. Because how could this little kid, 2.5 feet tall, be playing so well? I thought the whole thing would crumble like a house of cards and that it was some incredible psychological projection that was taking place every day in the park. And even when he would play in scholastic tournaments against other little kids, I thought it was something of an illusion that was happening. As Josh got older, thank God, I separated myself to a certain degree, and it became clear to me that he was playing the game and I was watching the game on an emotional level, of course, I'm talking. I mean, Now, when I watch Josh play, I can't say that it's a detached experience. I mean, in a way, I'm his manager. I'm his dad. I don't want him to lose. If he loses, he's miserable, and then I'm miserable. But it's not the same kind of experience emotionally, not as tortured as when he was a little kid.
Well, the parent-child relationships you describe are really the kind of quintessential stage parent, it seems, for a lot of them. Mm-hmm. There is this over-identification with their child's success or failure.
Right, right. And it's funny because it depends, again, on the perspective that you have on it. I mean, when one refers to a stage parent, it has invariably a negative connotation.
Oh, absolutely.
But once again, you can't have a John McEnroe without a Mr. McEnroe. You would never have a John McEnroe.
Fred Waitzkin's book about his son searching for Bobby Fischer was made into a movie, which is now out in video. His other book about world chess champion Garry Kasparov is called Mortal Games. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about some of the stories they'll be covering on All Things Considered today. Hi, Robert. What do you have for us?
Well, we'll be hearing today, Marty, about the new peace plan for Bosnia and the reactions to it, the map, that is, from the Bosnian government and from the Bosnian Serb Assembly. Also today, NPR's Michael Scholer reports on the flood of refugees out of Rwanda into neighboring Zaire. He's in Goma, where it seems for now the number of refugees has stabilized, but they still pose enormous problems to relief agencies. Also today we'll be hearing about the economic miracle in Tupelo, Mississippi, and about the controversy over Educational Alternatives, Inc.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Pianist Keith Jarrett got his first professional jazz break playing with a trio at the Deerhead Inn in the Delaware Water Gap. He was right out of high school and working at the time as a shipping clerk in Allentown, Pennsylvania. 2 years ago, Keith Jarrett returned to the Deerhead in a trio with his old colleagues Gary Peacock and Paul Motion. It was his first time back to the club in 30 years. The date was recorded, and now it's out on compact disc. Kevin Whitehead has a review.
It's trendy to dump on Keith Jarrett nowadays, both for his self-righteous pronouncements on stage and in the press, and for the runaway romanticism of his solo concerts. But with the right rhythm section, Jarrett could always be a very good jazz piano player. At best, his trios have a breezy, open quality he gets mostly from Ornette Coleman. Jarrett leaves space in the music to let it breathe. There is one catch. Lots of piano players have the annoying habit of singing along with themselves, but only Jarrett sounds like he's being heckled by Jerry Lewis. The tune is Jackie Byard's Chandra. In this trio, Jarrett shares equal billing with bassist Gary Peacock and drummer Paul Motion. That's fair. For the last 11 years, Peacock and Jarrett have been playing in the so-called Standards Trio with drummer Jack DeJohnette. Paul Motion, who'd played drums in some earlier Jarrett bands, has a lighter and looser touch than DeJohnette and makes this trio more relaxed. Motion and Peacock can play pretty much any style, so Jarrett can do whatever he wants, like slide toward Thelonious Monk's cheerful clunkers while trading phrases with the drummer. One positive trend in 90s jazz is the revival of tunes considered too corny a few years ago. This trio plays Jarrett's current fave, Bye Bye Blackbird, and the Dixieland warhorse, Basin Street Blues. It's true, Keith Jarrett has a high opinion of himself, but that's not unusual in an artist. The trick is to keep it out of the way when you're working. Once or twice on this record, you almost get the feeling Keith Jarrett has a sense of humor, maybe even about himself. In any case, At the Deerhead Inn is a good record, even with the Jerry Lewis voice.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Pulse CD Review, Coda, and The Village Voice. He reviewed Keith Jarrett's recording at the Deerhead Inn on the ECM label. Interviews and reviews on Fresh Air are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Roberta Shorrock, with Kathy Wolf and Jewel Bracey. Sue Spolin directed today's show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscowane.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the politics behind the tragedy in Rwanda. We'll talk to journalist Frank Smythe about the history of the troubled African nation and the conflict between the Hutus and the Tutsis. I'm Marty Moscowane, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.